one of my favorite Masechtot. I can't say that I've been successful in actually finishing the Gemara, but I've learned the Mishnah a few times. And it's also, I should point out, the favorite Masechet of our 10-year-old son, who especially loves all the prakim at the end with all the different kinds of capital punishment. So partly in his honor, I'll talk a little bit about capital punishment, but what I wanted to share basically are some similarities between the legal system that's embodied and described in Sanhedrin and the legal system that we have here in Israel, and then the one I'm more familiar with in the United States. And I was just going over the Masechet yesterday to see what parallels there were, and there actually are quite a lot of interesting parallels, comparisons, similarities between what is taught in Sanhedrin and how in the real world, so to speak, in contemporary legal systems, we actually operate. So one thing I thought I'd start with is the notion of cross-examination. And there's a famous quote by John Wigmore, who was a legendary early 20th century jurist and lawyer and wrote a number of treatises on evidence. He said, "Cross-examination is the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth." It's the best way to get to the truth, okay? Cross-examination, of course, is when you go to court and you have a chance to examine your witness, but then the other side has a chance to cross-examine your witness, to grill them and get down into the nitty-gritty and try to make them look like they're lying or expose something that's wrong in what they said. And it's to this day in all common law systems probably really is the most important way of getting at the truth. And of course, we see that in Sanhedrin as well, in Perek Shlishi and Perek Hamishi. There's a lot of discussion of exactly what you have to do to the witnesses to make sure that they're not lying. The drishot and the chakirot, you take them outside, you grill them. I think in Perek, I forget which mission it is, but there were sheva chakirot, be'ezo shavua, what week did this event happen? Be'ezo shana, be'ezo chodesh, be'kama b'chodesh, be'ezo yom, be'ezo sha'a, be'ezo makom. So it's not just a matter of getting at the truth, which is what Wigmore said, but it's a matter of fairness and getting at making sure that the person who has a case brought against them has every opportunity to get the truth to come out and to try to challenge what the witnesses are saying. So I think that's one very important feature. Another one is the distinction between civil and criminal cases. So in contemporary law, it's very important that you have on one hand, you have the track of civil cases, and the other hand, you have criminal cases. And specifically, that you have extra protections for criminal defendants in court. And that's definitely the case in Sanhedrin, Perek Daled. It talks about when you're talking about a capital case and you bring in witnesses, the bedikot and the chakirot are even more stringent and even more intense. And the notion that's quoted in Perek Daled Mishnehei, shekol ha'me'abed nefesh achat mi'Yisrael ma'ale alav hakatuv ki'ilu ibed olam male. They impress on the witnesses that if you're responsible for this person being put to death, let's say, it's as if you've destroyed a whole world. So no pressure. Other examples, too, in Sanhedrin, talk about for Dine Nefashot, you have to have a majority of two judges, right? It's not just enough to be split 2-1 12 to 11, right? It's got to actually be at least 13 to 10, right? It's got to be two or more of a distinction. And in the U.S., you have a similar notion that the burden of proof in a criminal case is much higher than the burden of proof in a civil case. Civil case, basically, you have to prove that you're right by 50% plus one little chemetz of more than that, whereas in criminal case, you have to prove they're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
But criminal case in law nowadays is not split by murder versus, right? Criminal could be other criminal cases, not murder related, correct?
Correct, correct.
Whereas criminal here, the distinction is different.
Is dine nefashot, right? Though I guess, so
there
how
could be dine mamonot, that could be criminal.
That's interesting. So
like
how would you
theft come up?
So that's well. That's what criminal. I would. What would that be? Would that be considered dine mamonot?
That's classic.
Okay.
Dine
interesting.
So
interesting.
It's an interesting distinction. That
right.
It's not the same. They draw the line in a different place.
Right. I think that's right. And I think what that reflects is in contemporary law, criminal acts are ones that basically mean you have to go to jail, And of course, in the time of the Gemara, there wasn't really a notion of jail. It was either you die or you pay a knas or you have to make recompense. So that's an important distinction, I think. But I guess if you want to put it in terms of murder versus everything else, I think it kind of works. Mm-hmm. So another one, there's in U.S. law and Israeli law, you have certain safeguards for the integrity of the process. You need to make sure that witnesses and judges are being upright, not just that they're telling the truth, but that they're actually reliable, and that they're scrupulous, and that they're not related to each other or biased. And of course, you have throughout Sanhedrin all the different laws about when witnesses are related and exactly how related they can be. You have the issue of Mesachek Bekubia, Milave Beribi, right? To certain witnesses who engage in certain conduct, that conduct is inherently unreliable. The one distinction, though, I think, is in U.S. law. If you are in one of those categories, you're still allowed to testify, but on cross-examination, the other side can say, well, isn't it true that you're a liar, or you've been convicted of a crime, or you're actually related to the person you're testifying for? So it's you recognize it, but it's treated in a different way. A few other quick ones. You have an odd number of judges, right? Seems like a very simple idea, but I think the origin of it, it certainly is in Sanhedrin, maybe some of the other ancient Near Eastern cultures, but you have to have an odd number. Otherwise, you're going to have a split judgment. So in U.S. courts, you usually have one judge at the trial level, but at the appellate level, you have three judges, a three-judge panel, and then, of course, the Supreme Court, you have nine judges. I think in Israel, it's similar.
Jury
I think
is 12.
So a jury, it can be even numbers, it can be odd numbers. In criminal cases, generally, you have to have a unanimous jury to convict someone. And even in certain civil cases, generally, the courts like to have a unanimous jury, at least in federal court. So one other thought is selection of judges. So I think it's in Perek Gimel, where the each side gets to choose which judge they're going to use. And the way it works, it's the machloket, but the first idea is that one side chooses one judge, the other side chooses the second judge, and between them, they choose the third, or the other option is the two judges that are chosen in turn choose the third. And these methods are actually used today in arbitration, not in the court system, but in arbitration systems, where you have to pick, each side has to pick someone they're comfortable with, and that's exactly the methodologies that are used there. So I thought that was kind of neat. All right, and then I'll just kind of wrap up with a more, I don't know, maybe a little bit more of a moralistic one, which is capital punishment. So I think there are some very interesting parallels between the way that Dinei Nefashot, capital punishment, is taught and discussed in Sanhedrin and in the real world. And essentially there are, at least as far as I'm familiar with, there are three main justifications for capital punishment. One is deterrence, one is prevention, and one is sort of a little more amorphous, an expression of the goals and the aspirations of a society. And I'll explain what I mean by each of those. Deterrence is sort of the most obvious one, and there's a furious debate in contemporary society over whether or not having the death penalty actually deters people from murdering. I read a recent study over the summer. It was in the Washington Post. It was a study of studies that said that actually the latest evidence says that, believe it or not, capital punishment, death penalty, does deter between 3 and 18 murders per year, depending on what evidence you look at. But of course, even those studies are hotly disputed. But put to the side whether or not it's true that it deters or not, that's always been an important justification for Dinei Nefashot, for capital punishment. So, and this is true also in the Mishnah. The best source for this actually comes from Makot, which you're about to start on, but I think it's okay for me to include it because originally Makot was really part of Sanhedrin. So at the end of Perek Aleph, there's a very famous Mishnah, Sanhedrin Hahoreget Achad B'Shavua Nikret Chavlanit. A Sanhedrin that puts to death one person in 7 years is considered a murderous, awful, bloodthirsty Sanhedrin. Rabbi Elazar ben Azari omer echad l'shivim shana. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azari says, even once in 70 years to put one person to death is terrible. Rabbi Talfan v'Rabbi Akiva omrim, ilu hayinu b'Sanhedrin lo neherag adam me'olam. If we were judges, we would never kill anybody. So we'll get to that part in a minute. But the clear implication of that, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, af hen marbin shofchei damim b'Yisrael. So Rabban Shimon Gamliel says, wait a minute. You guys are all trying to outdo each other for how pure and how tamim you are. But guess what? If that were the case, if you really didn't have the death penalty, you would be marbim shofchei damim b'Yisrael. You would be encouraging and proliferating bloodshed and murder in the world. Without the death penalty, that's what would happen. So I thought that was an interesting way to look at the issues of deterrence. Prevention is the second category. It's not exactly deterrence, but it's saying not that if we impose a death penalty on Debbie, that's going to prevent Aviva from killing someone in the world. But if we impose a death penalty on Debbie, that's going to prevent Debbie from ever killing anybody. And the notion is some people are so irredeemable, not you, sweetheart, for sure, but some people are so awful that they're totally unrehabilitatable. There's no way we can bring them back, and therefore the only thing we can do with them is to kill them. And that idea actually comes up with the Ben Sorer Moreh in Perek Chet. We say, Ben Sorer Moreh Nidon Al Shem Sopo, Yamut Zakai V'Al Yamut Chayav. It's better that he die now as an innocent person than that he die Chayav. Shemitatan Shel Rasha'im Hana'a Lahen V'Hana'a La'Olam. When wicked people are put to death, actually ties into the end of what you learned today, it's good for them and it's good for the world to get rid of them. So that's the notion of prevention. I think that one is probably one of the weakest arguments. The last one, though, I wanted to say is, and this I found the most convincing personally about the death penalty, even though I struggle with it myself, is this idea that some crimes are so awful, so heinous, and so obscene that only the death penalty can adequately punish them. There's no other way to punish them. It's not necessarily it's going to deter anybody. It's not just that it's going to prevent this person from ever dying. But as a community, we've decided certain crimes are so bad that there's no other way around them.
Does that make the community feel better?
That's the idea. It makes the community feel better. It's our expression of what our values are. And I think that's sort of the flip side of the quote from Makot. That even if, and this is an argument for having a death penalty on the books, but not even necessarily using it all that much, that even if we never put someone to death, right? What you could ask, these guys who are trying to outdo themselves, never in 70 years, well, why do you even have a death penalty? Well, the idea is that it's still an expression of what we believe in. And that's true also of the Ben Sora Moreh, right? As you guys have learned, the Ben Sora Moreh never actually happened, right? The restrictions that are put on the age that it could happen, and they have to drink a tarte, they have to eat a tarte mar basar and drink half a gallon of wine. The conditions are so extreme that it could never actually happen, and the Gemara says it never actually did happen. But that's how it is. So in Israel, it's interesting, there is a death penalty on the books. It does exist. But in 1954, the Knesset abolished the death penalty for all crimes except for crimes against humanity, war crimes, treason, and certain offenses during war. So murder is not on the table for the death penalty in Israel anymore. I think theoretically, even terrorists who mass murder Israelis are not put to death. They aren't put to death. I don't know if they can. I don't think they can be, generally. And only two people have ever been executed by the State of Israel. Anyone know who they are? Eichmann, right? That's the famous one in 1962 for war crimes. Anyone know who the other one was? Very obscure. I had to look this up. A guy named Meir Tobiansky, who was executed in 1948, in the middle of the Milchemet HaShichur, for espionage. But guess what? After he was put to death, he was posthumously exonerated, that they found that he was convicted on wrong evidence. So I think that kind of goes to point out all these issues, right, of capital punishment, that the notion of it makes sense to us intuitively, but it's a very difficult thing to try to grapple with what how to actually deal with it. So in any event, I think there's some interesting parallels. Kol hakavod again on finishing my favorite masechet, and good luck with Makot.